Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Allegra Chapman of Common Cause, who discusses her group's concerns in response to the Senate confirmation of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as President Trump's Attorney General. Chase Iron Eyes, an attorney with a Standing Rock Sioux tribe, who talks about what may be opponents' last stand to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline after President Trump authorized construction on the project to resume. And veteran political activist and organizer Leslie Kagan, who assesses how the anti-Trump resistance movement can be sustained for the long haul and form an enduring and powerful progressive movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
France's far-right leader, Marie Le Pen, kicked off her presidential campaign in Trump-like fashion, declaring this is our country. Le Pen's National Front Party also published a campaign manifesto that dramatically cuts legal immigration, expels all undocumented migrants, and limits public services like free education to French citizens. Le Pen hopes to ride a wave of surging anti-globalization and anti-EU sentiment in France to a surprise victory, with the collapse of conservative candidate François Fillon embroiled in a family patronage scandal. Le Pen is now expected to win the first round of the French presidential election in late April. Yet early polls show Le Pen losing by a 2-1 margin in the runoff against independent centrist Emmanuel Macron, a former economy minister for the outgoing socialist president François Hollande. Macron founded his own political party, En Marche, in April 2016. A recent international poll of 22 nations conducted by the newspaper Le Figaro found French citizens were the most hostile to globalization, even more so than Americans, where Donald Trump won the presidency by espousing hardline views on immigration and trade. According to the poll, conducted last fall by the firm Ipsos, two-thirds of French citizens feel the nation is in decline. Historically, this level of pessimism has fueled far-right and nationalist parties and candidates. After an outcry from veterans groups, doctors and nurses and other health professionals were exempted from the Trump administration's hiring freeze at the Veterans Health Administration. Initially, the Trump White House didn't exempt VA employees from the freeze of federal workers. But after protests from veteran advocates, the American Prospect reports VA Secretary Robert Snyder issued a memo permitting the hiring of health professionals. But the VA still has 41,000 vacant positions, a number which is expected to grow as workers retire and leave for new jobs. Inside the VA, clinical managers are pushing hard to expand the job categories exempted from the hiring freeze. A high-ranking VA administrator lamented, "We are in limbo and may have to renege on offers made to job candidates." The hiring freeze and push for exemptions has created confusion at the VA and discouraged many health professionals from looking for careers at the federal agency. Critics fear this chaos may be by design. Instability at the VA could serve as a convenient justification for the Trump administration to push for their real goal, privatization, a move vigorously opposed by a strong majority of veterans and veterans groups. Over the last 15 years, 33 states, mostly in America's Northeast and the South, cut carbon emissions while growing their economies. Over time, carbon reductions were achieved by increased reliance on generating electricity with natural gas and nuclear power instead of carbon-heavy coal, although climate researchers remind policymakers that natural gas, a fossil fuel, produces carbon emissions as well. And the continuing disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant, which suffered multiple meltdowns in March 2011, is a reminder of the high risks associated with nuclear energy. However, according to the Christian Science Monitor, a new report by the centrist Brookings Institution explored these new trends toward cleaner energy on a state-by-state basis. These carbon reductions are expected to continue despite the rollback of climate change initiatives by the Trump White House. Over time, states have been the innovators in energy policy, establishing clean energy funds, renewable energy financing, and developing carbon emission targets. But the Trump administration's hostility toward clean energy will be felt quickly, with the possible loss of renewable energy tax credits and the reversal of Obama-era regulations on curbing carbon dioxide emissions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
By a 52-47 vote on February 8th, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions was confirmed by his Senate colleagues to become President Trump's Attorney General. His narrow victory underscored the bitter controversy surrounding Sessions and the many charges against him for racial bias in speech and action and holding homophobic views. Many civil rights and social justice groups who had opposed his nomination expressed dismay that Mr. Sessions will now become the nation's top law enforcement official. Despite his long history of opposing civil rights and voting rights legislation, as well as measures advocating equal treatment of all Americans, regardless of their race, religion, or sexual orientation. The bitterness of the fight was in full view when Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky used an arcane Senate rule to silence Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, when she attempted to read into the record a 1986 letter from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s widow, Coretta Scott King, who had written to the senators, urging them to reject the nomination of Sessions for a federal judgeship at the time, which they did. Your reporter spoke with Allegra Chapman, director of voting and elections with Common Cause. Here she discusses her group's response to the Senate confirmation of Jeff Sessions and plans to ensure as Attorney General he's held accountable for any conduct determined to be biased or unjust.
So what we're most concerned with is that Jeff Sessions would just not be enforcing the remainder of the Voting Rights Act as it exists today. So Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act exists today, and it's a really strong tool in order to ensure that laws that states try to pass not be permitted to stay on the books if they are in fact discriminatory, if they have a discriminatory impact. For Obama's Department of Justice, we saw them really pursue a lot of litigation or get involved in some cases in which discrimination when it comes to voting was on the block. We are concerned that Jeff Sessions, especially considering everything that he said about the Voting Rights Act, would either pull some of those really strong briefs from some cases or, just fail to pursue these sorts of lawsuits altogether. And that has a real impact for people on the ground. Some of these discriminatory laws, like photo ID laws, can affect hundreds of thousands of people in each state. For example, in Texas, the court found that a photo ID law was going to prevent 600,000 people from voting. In Wisconsin, a photo ID law, one of the courts said, could have impacted around 300,000 people. So, these are the kinds of things, they're not just theoretical issues. I think they really have impact on the ground and can ultimately prevent people from really participating in our democracy. I think this is a time right now where we're really calling more on people to really to show up, to vote, to be a part of their community, to participate. And when we see folks within the government trying to curb that and prevent that from happening, that's a real problem, and it's also an illegal one.
Allegra, Donald Trump, during his election campaign and since he's been sworn into office, has often talked about what he claims are instances of massive voter fraud with millions of illegal aliens voting and other ancillary charges that are unsupported by fact. Many of us call that a lie. At any rate, Donald Trump is making these claims. Are you concerned that this narrative will feed into more draconian voter suppression laws across the country, and specifically in those states governed by Republican governors and legislatures?
Yeah, you bet I'm concerned. You know, many of us are concerned. And I'm glad to hear you and other reporters and journalists call this out for what it is. It is, in fact, a lie. You know, there's just no proof that any of this has happened. In fact, a number of studies have been conducted over the years with respect to election issues and whether or not illegal voting takes place. You know, both the DOJ under George W. Bush, in addition to the DOJ under Obama, plus a handful of other experts have studied the issue. They have looked at the details of elections. They have studied ballots. And they can confirm resoundingly that the kind of illegalities, that this sort of widespread voter fraud simply does not exist. And yet Trump, and, you know, so do a number of other people who are either trying to push his agenda or who are working for him, continues to sound off this message.
Well, Allegra, just a final quick question. Are you optimistic at all that Jeff Sessions will be more careful about the appearance of bias toward racial minorities and the LGBTQ community because of the scrutiny he received in the Senate confirmation hearings?
You know, I think that's a really excellent question. All I can say is I hope so. Common Cause, you know, has really engaged our membership on this issue. They have been following Jeff Sessions. They have been looking into his history. Even though he is now head of the Department of Justice, despite our best efforts, you know, we've called on our citizenry to continue to sort of watch Sessions and make sure that he abides by promises that he made to uphold the law, to enforce the law for all. And so we do have a Watch Sessions campaign for our membership. And I think really that's what people can and should be doing now, is the way that you hold power accountable, the way that you hold your representatives accountable, or even those who are appointed to executive agencies, is by being the eyes and ears, you know. And if we see that Jeff Sessions is not abiding by what is required of him, you know, by the job description, then this is something that we need the media to continue to kind of like expound on. Ultimately, at the end of the day, things change during elections, but we do want to stay vigilant.
That was Allegra Chapman, Director of Voting and Elections with Common Cause. Find links to the group's new Sessions Watch webpage and related information and resources by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The fight to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline has reached another crisis point as the Trump administration has given the final go-ahead to build the pipeline under the Missouri River. This mile-and-a-half section will connect two segments of the more than 1,100-mile pipeline that will take 500,000 barrels a day of dirty explosive Bakken oil from North Dakota across South Dakota and Iowa into Illinois, where it will connect to other pipelines taking the fossil fuel to the Gulf Coast for refining. Hundreds of people have remained at protest camps to act as water protectors since the Obama administration announced on December 4th that it would require a full environmental impact statement on the project. Now that Trump's Army Corps of Engineers has reversed that finding, hundreds more people are returning to what they're calling their last stand against the pipeline, including three contingents of veterans. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe has also filed the last-ditch legal effort to pause the pipeline, but even the tribal chairman, Dave Archambault, has said it's unlikely to be successful. 76 water protectors were arrested on February 1st when they refused to leave a new encampment set up outside the floodplain where the other camps were originally erected. One of those arrested was Chase Iron Eyes, an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, an attorney with the Lakota People's Law Project, and a co-founder of the Native American news website Last Real Indians. In this recording of a talk given by Iron Eyes on February 7th, he describes the current situation and asks for help from supporters, either by traveling to Standing Rock or protesting against the banks funding the project wherever they live across the nation.
Hello, this is Chase Iron Eyes. I'm live from Sequimuc territory in Kamloops, British Columbia, and I came up here to attempt to build solidarity with not only First Nations, but anybody who is prepared to be a water protector. We still stand with the water. We still stand with the sacred sites at the confluence of the Missouri and Cannonball Rivers. And as of today, word is out on the wire that the United States Army Corps of Engineers has granted the easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline to be drilled under our only source of clean drinking water, putting not only our water, but 10 to 15 million people downstream from the proposed pipeline route, putting their drinking water at risk, indeed putting our entire ecosystem and the 100 miles of our, not only our shoreline at the Standing Rock Nation where I am enrolled and where I live, but the Cheyenne River Tribal Nation also has approximately 100 miles of shoreline right south of the Standing Rock Nation. Now, with the approval of this easement, notice of that approval is going to the United States Congress right now, but it's important to understand that the United States Congress doesn't have the authority to approve or deny this permit anymore. They can weigh in on it in a policy matter. It's also important to note that President Trump sent a memo that waives the courtesy waiting period that the Army Corps usually observes in these types of situations, and that was a 14-day waiting period that has been waived by President Trump. So theoretically, drilling underneath the Missouri River could start anytime. This is an emergency situation given the fact that February 22nd is the date that the United States Army Corps of Engineers is threatening, making it publicly known that they intend to evacuate the entirety of the Ocheti Oyate camp, or the Ocheti Shokowi camp, the camp which is north of the 1889 boundary line, which was set illegally when the United States annexed what is now Morton County for their benefit and to our detriment. And so we haven't asserted ourselves in the treaty territory for over 120 years. And I want to make clear, just put those details out there and to let people know that if you are coming, if you are self-sufficient, if you are disciplined, you are among a couple thousand people who are already coming back, including three contingents of United States veterans who intend to come and stand with us on the ground in peace and in dignity, in furtherance and in exercise of their human rights, their constitutional rights, and their civil liberties, and in promotion and in support of Native nations' right to assert their international identity in what is now become the, what has now become the focal point in the fight against Trump tyranny at the confluence of the Cannonball and Missouri rivers. And so we are going to prepare for that. It's very disheartening to know that the victory that was proclaimed December 4th has turned out to be nothing more than a hollow, meaningless, pointless, and false victory. We don't seek violence. We don't even seek to be aggressive. And we don't call out for that. Yet I am being charged with a felony, inciting a riot. I'm facing 5 years maximum in prison. But this fight is not about me. This is about our children and the next seven generations, and whether or not we're willing to pass on to them a land and waters and an earth that is healthy, from which they can derive a living from, just as our ancestors sacrificed for us. We are being called on right now to make that determination, but we have to do it in peace and in dignity. Thank you.
That was attorney and activist Chase Iron Eyes of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Learn more about the resistance being organized in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After just 3 weeks in office, Donald Trump has led a chaotic and scandal-plagued administration into the history books as the most unpopular incoming president in modern American history. From day one of his inauguration to the present, there have been countless protests targeting the Trump agenda. From the millions who gathered nationwide for the historic January 21st Women's March to spontaneous demonstrations at airports across the country in opposition to Trump's Muslim ban executive order. Tens of thousands of longtime activists, joined by people new to protests, have come out in large numbers to challenge federal ICE raids deporting immigrants and oppose legislation to defund Planned Parenthood and the repeal of Obamacare. Both Democrat and Republican legislators have seen thousands of angry progressive activists attend town hall meetings and flood congressional switchboards with phone calls, unhappy with the direction of government policies under Trump and the GOP-controlled Congress. Your reporter spoke with Leslie Kagan, one of the nation's most accomplished peace and social justice activists. She's organized some of the largest political protests in U.S. history, including the 1982 anti-nuclear weapons march in New York City's Central Park, the groundbreaking 1987 protests for gay and lesbian rights, the giant 2003 protests in opposition to the Iraq War, and New York City's People's Climate March in September 2015. Here, Kagan discusses the amazing explosion of anti-Trump organizing going on around the U.S. and offers her assessment of how this activism can be sustained for the long haul and form an enduring and powerful progressive movement.
I think there are two extremely remarkable things happening at the same moment here. One is the Trump phenomenon. Trump, and when I say Trump, I mean his whole administration, every single member of his cabinet and his inner circle and his appointments, as well as the, of course, the incredibly far right-wing control of the United States Congress. You know, the whole political moment that we're in this country is, I think, extremely frightening and like nothing I've ever seen in my life. At the same time, there's also incredible and exciting and dynamic and powerful, out in the streets, in your face reaction to Trump. And again, I say Trump to mean all of that. And that is something I think we can all get some measure of hope from.
In the short run, what are the things that have to be done to keep this movement sustainable, to strengthen it for the long haul?
Right. I worry, where are we going to be in 6 months or a year? Because who knows what's going to happen to Trump per se, but the people around him are not going away. What he has unleashed in this country is not going to be bottled up so quickly. So we have to be in this for the long haul, too. And I think that some of what needs to happen is beginning to happen, and that is people are not only going to demonstrations, they're also going to organizing meetings. They're finding groups that already exist and joining them, or they're forming new groups. And that is very, very important. Believe me, I wish I or somebody had the formula, do step A, step B, step C, and then everything would be nice and tidy, and we'd know we could secure our future here. But it doesn't work that way. So I hope that people, do find groups, do form new groups, and engage in this work in community, right, as part of groupings outside of their, immediate friendship circle or families or coworkers, but that they broaden out and begin engaging in this work with other folks in a very systematic and organized way. The other thing that I think, there's been a lot of talk, I hear it from all quarters now, of solidarity and unity, and we have to support one another, we have to stand together. We have to go beyond just the rhetoric of that, though, and this really is an opportunity for us to do something that a lot of people on the left and in progressive organizations have talked about for some time in this country, but now it's really not only an opportunity, but a kind of history demands it of us, that we find a way to step out of our particular issue, focus or constituency or community work, and really begin to build organizations and projects and campaigns and coalitions that bring different constituencies and different issues together, and to build unity in a very practical, hands-on kind of way. I think it's clear that if each of us in our organizations, you know, just goes alone, we will not work. It won't work. We will not succeed. But there is our greatest potential, I think, lies in building that kind of unified social change movement. And I think the opportunity is upon us here. I think the openings are there.
There's a lot of discussion about an inside and outside strategy that's necessary for any effective movement to have impact. You have to have the street heat, as they call it, but you also have to have some impact at the ballot box. You have to be able to change the personnel in your state legislatures, in your city hall, and of course, in Congress and the White House. So how do you see this particular movement at its early stages approaching that important issue of inside and outside both being important?
I agree with you. I think it's critically important. It's several layers of work or several pieces of work that need to be done in a way that reinforce one another. One is to keep and expand the pressure on people who are already elected, whether that's at the city council or whatever level of government it is, to keep the heat on those already serving as our elected representatives. And then the other piece of it is to really, and I think the potential is there, to actually galvanize the electorate by putting forth candidates that actually come from and speak to the communities that they want to represent. People who are energetic, who are serious, who are not afraid to go against the powers that be, who will speak the truth and take action when it's needed, and have them run for office and inspire voters. It has to be done hand in hand with that kind of visible street heat, people in the streets kind of movement. If you just have one or the other, then we're not going to be strong enough. I think both are very much needed.
That was veteran political activist and organizer Leslie Kagan. For more discussion and commentary on the future of the growing anti-Trump movement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.